Hi, I'm Rukmini Vijay Kumar. I'm a dancer and choreographer from Bangalore. I primarily work in the Bharatanatyam vocabulary, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Yeah. My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. Hi, everyone. On this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, a conversation with dance artist and choreographer, Rukmini Vijayakumar. Stay tuned. You know, as we find ourselves in 2024, I find myself thinking about how innovation and creation are happening at a simply breathtaking speed. Whether it's AI transforming just about everything, or following the pace of artistic trends online, the idea of creating something meaningful, from at least the viewer's perspective, sometimes might feel, well, effortless. For what it's worth, I know you devote effort and put a lot of energy into listening to this podcast, so I'm quite grateful to you for being a part of it and sharing it with your friends. Now, in a world of superficial effortlessness, I wanted to talk about the opposite, that which actually takes time and attention to detail to express a physical and mental balance and energy. Now, for those who are particularly studying and aiming to perfect a classical performing art form like Bharatanatyam, especially in a world that seems to be governed by instant and fast gratification, there's undoubtedly a true celebration of effort and an incredible self-awareness in order to demonstrate expertise and even mastery. So I was thankful to share a conversation with Rukmini Vijayakumar, a dance artist and choreographer based in Bangalore in Karnataka, India. She's the artistic director of the Radha Kalpa Dance Company and creative director of Lashwa, a space for artists. She's also the founder of the Radha Kalpa Method, an educational system of Bharatanatyam pedagogy that's based on the idea of neutrality of body and mind. Rukmini has performed as a soloist all over the world, and her style of performance is greatly influenced by the ancient movement practice of Karanas. A graduate of the Boston Conservatory, and having studied ballet and acting and other diverse forms of expressions, her choreographies draw from the ancient, retaining tradition even while making them relevant to a contemporary world. Now, I think those expressions of the Bharatanatyam vocabulary not only speak to Rukmini's audiences, but they allow her to challenge her own opinion at every juncture, keeping her work relevant and alive. We caught up to chat about it all, and I started by asking her about how years of studying and performing and teaching have perhaps made her a better observer of dance.
Yeah, I think I do. I observe a lot. I think that also comes as a part of being a teacher and a choreographer, because you become very picky about especially aesthetic alignment and how things are done or where bodies are placed in space. So yeah. When I watch performances, I usually go with the intention of enjoying a performance, but I do it afterward because I don't want to ever lose that ability to be a connoisseur of art while I am an artist as well, you know? So I do like to go to performances just to watch, like to enjoy them.
Right.
But once it's done, I do go back and also think about what I did enjoy, where I was lost, why I was lost, if I particularly liked something, why I liked it. So it becomes a learning experience for me, even when I'm watching other things.
I wonder with that then, as you of course have that kind of innate joy of watching dance, do you find that because you become even better observer of dance, that when you're practicing or when you're even performing, that you're a little more self-aware about your own ability to perfect the movement or create a new movement or even think about a new kind of movement that you perhaps had never explored before, simply because you've observed it now and been able to synthesize that a little bit differently?
When I'm dancing myself, it's actually not possible to be thinking of the movement. That's the idea of practice. You practice so much that the movement becomes second nature. So all this thinking and analyzing happens in the studio when I'm repeating things or doing it multiple times. But when I'm actually dancing, I have to let go of the critical eye. And I just have to dance and trust that the work is done at that time.
We have this whole cycle, at least in training and medicine, of how you become consciously competent and sometimes unconsciously competent. You're doing something, but you have no idea why you're doing it. But then again, not thinking about it actually becomes an innate skill, but perfecting it requires that conscious competency. So I'm curious for you, if is it something that as you either are choreographing or actually performing yourself, are there two different lanes that you have to sit in so that you can actually discover and fine-tune things as you go along?
Yeah, I actually wrote about this idea in my book. There's a lot of practice and a lot of repetition, a lot of really critical, self-aware, particular movement practice that has to happen for years and years and years. And you do so much practice so that you can completely let go of it when you're actually dancing. So this practice that becomes a part of you, you're hoping that it becomes second nature, like breathing. So you actually don't need to remember to do it. It's just there. And it's just a part of your vocabulary. It's a part of your system. So if there's an 8-count cycle, you just know when the cycle ends. You know when it's going to begin. So even if you're layering rhythm, something goes wrong, you know how to get it back, you know? So when the rhythm and the music and your physical aesthetic become second nature to you, I actually believe that the dance begins then. Until then, you actually can't dance at all. Yeah.
For a lot of artists, of course, this has begun through years and years of very devoted study, but also in that kind of guru shishya relationship.
Yeah.
How much for you does a reverence to that relationship play a role in your ongoing practice? And particularly now, as you have stepped into that role as a teacher, as in some ways having that kind of expert analysis of how to advance the art form.
I lost both my teachers when I was very young. I think I was 21, 22 at that time. So I've been by myself since then. More recently, I've started going, once in 6 months or once in 8 months still, like to see Paduaka, who's my teacher's teacher. But it's not like a regular like class. So I go sometimes and then I do like Karana's practice or I spend time with her. But I have I think I have such a deep reverence for all my dance teachers, my Bharatanatyam teachers, my ballet and modern teachers, everyone included, because I don't think I could get this far if they didn't help me skip a lot of steps that I would have had to go through on my own. And I think that's what a teacher is there for, to help you skip like 10, 15 steps, and they just pick you up and they put you like a little bit, they give you a little push, you know, because you don't need to do that figuring out. But while they do that, it's also, I also know for a fact that I think I was an amazing student. I think I love being a student, because
it's almost like you want to keep being an amazing student and live in that same kind of role.
I would love to just be a student my whole life and have my teachers. But unfortunately, I don't have that exactly.
That's a tough role to constantly be in, I guess, too.
Yeah. So in dance itself, it's an inherited art form, no matter what way you see it. No one in any form of dance, even the most modern, neo-modern contemporary dancers who are creating a movement as well, you know, there is some vocabulary that is learned from a generation before us. And there, I do believe that there is a reverence that is necessary for each one of us as dancers to further ourselves as artists in general. like no matter what kind of practice we have, because there is a lineage, there is a history, and everyone has contributed to the movement that I have in my body right now. So it's not something that I made up myself.
Right. And if you think about that, that you have that joy in constantly thinking of yourself as a student. Now, as you mentioned, you've been doing this on your own for some time as an instructor, as a teacher, as a choreographer, as a dance artist. In that same vein, appreciating what it's like to be a student, what are you learning from your students in return?
I think my students have taught me to break down many of the choices that I made intuitively. So when I, after my teachers passed away, when I would create and work, I was always just working on myself. But then when I had to communicate some of those ideas, I had to analytically try to get them to do what I was doing, but now communicate it in a very systematic and clear way. So after doing that for like 10 years or 12 years, I started calling my pedagogical system the Radha Kalpa method, because I didn't have a specific name. I don't follow a specific bani. I do what my teachers do, but I also do other things in terms of how I educate. So I think my students, being with my students, I've learned a lot about how to make the playing game, I don't know how to say it, make the playing field even for people with bodies that are different, for people who have different backgrounds, different habits. And I've learned a lot about physicality. I've learned a lot about how to make someone imagine, how to break down imagination.
Yeah.
Just a lot of things about how to be precise in communicating. Yeah.
Has that pedagogy, you know, that you've developed with Radha Kalpa, has that changed you as a person? Was that something that was in some ways kind of an aha moment for you to carry that forward?
Yeah, I think I had a lot of aha moments with that when I was actually breaking it down. The pedagogy primarily came from trying to fix myself, my own body. I would watch my own videos because I lost my teachers young. So I would watch and try to see what to make better. And many times I didn't know. So I would have to go through, try things, and then watch again and see, you know, why doesn't it look right? Or why am I getting pain in my ankles? Or why is my knee paining? You know, so there were a lot of things that I had to anatomically work out, as well as emotively, because I was always someone who was drawn into my imagination. So I could easily cry, easily get angry, easily shed tears. But then at which point do I need to harness the, I call it the observer or the witness. And when do you resolve it? When does the theatrical moment pass? So these are things that I had to learn for myself. And when I started breaking it down into quantifiable topics that I would teach my students, there were many things that I learned along the way. So there's a lot of learning that happened for me because of needing to communicate clearly to my students, as well as from the questions they asked me. It made me either revisit my ideals or reinforce them, both.
You know, that I've heard at least you describe that theme of pedagogy as a neutrality to your teaching method. And so if you had to describe what that means, and for that matter, why is neutrality in this way so important and central to is making sure that you can communicate Bharatanatyam in a clear way, not just to your students, but of course to your audiences?
I think neutrality applies in two frameworks. One is the emotive framework, and two is the physical framework. In the emotive framework, it's important to have a neutral and open mind in order for emotions to be able to come in and overwhelm you. Even as an actor or a performer, many times we know the script and we know what's going to happen. But how do you approach that moment, like it's the first time you ever heard that news. It's the first time that person ever said something like that to you. So that's what I mean by coming from a neutral place emotively. So you don't already have an expected emotive idea that needs to emanate from that moment. Eventually, this will help a performer, like how I'm trying to train them. It will help them go into a place, have an imaginary, enter an imaginary sphere, know the imaginary character, and just respond at that moment without a choreography being preset. So it helps to create improvisationally strong dancers. But I don't do that immediately. I do teach them subtext and all of that in the beginning. But neutrality is mainly to have an open, like a quiet emotional mind. Otherwise, many times we do things with our bodies, like in terms of worry or upset or like anger, that we expect to have before we actually have it.
It's almost the having an unbiased silence, perhaps, when you start.
Yes. Yeah. In both ways. And physically, I do that because I think when we talk about different styles or schools of Bharatanatyam, they have a dynamic accent on the adhiva. So the adhiva has a dynamic accent attached to it while the student learns it in class. So I try to make the adhiva plain as much as possible so that the dynamic accents can come in within the context of a choreography. So you don't have bright sun, so you can have quiet sun, you can have lazy sun, slow sun, languorous sun. So it's not always bright sun.
Yeah, almost there's so many different descriptors. It's like in Sanskrit, the sun has 1,000 names. Ganesh has 1,000 names. Vishnu has 1,000 names, right? I mean, it's being able to extract so many different rays of that light.
Yeah. So within the movement also, this is a little bit harder, but I've tried my best to include it because the dance vocabulary itself has a certain, leads itself to certain particular dynamics of movement, which are sharp and angular. But I try to make it as neutral as possible so that my students can have more choice within a choreography.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with dancer and choreographer Rukmini Vijayakumar. Stay tuned. Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, this is Vidya Balan, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hi, this is Farhan Akhtar.
Hi, guys. I'm Ananya Pandey.
Hi, this is Madhuri Dixit, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Rukmini Vijayakumar. You know, I read a review that described you as both engaging but authoritative. And I imagine your students would probably, you know, have, you know, some thoughts about that. But I'm curious for you, is this an apt description, not just for yourself as an artist and a teacher, but also you just generally as a person?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. I think it's probably.
I was just going to say, has that taken shape over time? Is that something that has evolved for you?
Yeah, I think I've always been, how do I say, pigheaded about things. Like,
Strong-willed.
Yeah, so if I believe something is right or I know something is right, I won't let go. I mean, if someone gives me proof, I will immediately let go of it. But until I have clear enough, I'm not someone who won't accept, like,
push back or accept.
I'm not someone who won't accept another point of view. I'm very open to other points of view. But if I know my point of view is clearer and more logical, I won't accept something just to accept it. If theirs has clarity and it's opposing and completely destroys my point of view, I would actually willingly accept it. But it's but until that point, I will hang on to what I guess
that's the balance between engaging and authoritarian, right? Yeah. That they are you're a dynamic listener, but you are strong in your thoughts.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's a nice way to put it.
Okay. Well, and I mean, you know, as I wonder if that actually allows you to be open to so many different forms of dance and art and artistry in general, right? With having studied ballet and acting and other diverse forms of expression for yourself, does it at all make then teaching more complex to you because you have so many different disciplines and so many eyes that are so many vantage points that you've been able to experience? Does that versatility ever come at the expense then of mastery when you're trying to perfect something? Or is it just additive that these things actually help you because of the versatility that it adds?
I think for me, whatever I learn feeds into Bharatanatyam. It's like Bharatanatyam is like my ocean, and everything else is like a river that comes into it. So it's not something like I have Bharatanatyam and then I have some ballet and then I'll do fusion. Like, no, I would never do that. Like, it's so wrong in my mind that it just doesn't work. So, but there are values from my ballet class that I do learn both physically as well as in terms of how I approach movement and muscularity that have helped my Bharatanatyam practice. But it doesn't mean that every Bharatanatyam dancer needs to learn ballet. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that for me, it's helpful and it has helped me. So I would never change my years in a ballet class. As well as my modern class, I learned so many other things about weight shift. I think that influences how I choreograph my Bharatanatyam, because I actually use, I think that would be one of the most defining things for me choreographically speaking, what would make my work different. If someone to say, one of the things is that I use weight shift to decide my next movement as opposed to an arbitrary choice of direction.
Is that a direct, you know, kind of learning or value that you've really, really, that strengthened your Bharatanatyam practice because you've studied other forms of dance?
I think that it's made my Bharatanatyam unique to me. Like, I don't know any other way to do my Bharatanatyam. It's not that I try to be different in my Bharatanatyam, but this is the only way that I know to do it. And so because I've been informed maybe by other things, but it's not a conscious, I will fuse this.
Right.
I will take this movement from ballet and stick it into my Bharatanatyam vocabulary. So it's not like that.
I've seen some of your, you know, recent work and some of the productions that you've done in the past few years, and it made me think a little bit of how your expression can be a manifestation of spirituality. And I wanted to ask you whether you consider yourself to be a spiritual artist or rather an artistically spiritual person?
I think it's something that people presume that artistry gives you, but it's like artists can be the most selfish and horrible people in the world. Mm. Art can lead you to a more spiritual journey, but I think that unless you are spiritual in your world, it doesn't necessarily permeate into your art. It's not that, like, because you are a Bharatanatyam dancer, you're, I mean, spiritual because you're doing Bharatanatyam.
It's not necessarily classical. Automatic.
Yeah, no, it's not at all.
Yeah.
It could just be a practice, and you could just sing and dance about Shiva and then have nothing of the philosophy permeate your life at all. So I think it's a conscious choice for me. And I think the more I grow spiritually, the more it permeates into my art.
When you were first learning and in your first performances and compared to now, has that spirituality been something you've had to discover, or has harnessing it been something that's come as a surprise, or have you innately already always known that you're a spiritual person and the artistry is just coming, both of these things are flowing naturally for you?
I think I always knew with dance, it was something that would bring me closer to myself. I could be quiet. I could be locked up in the studio for hours and hours. And we didn't have cell phones then. So no digital devices, right, or anything else, just my music system and me and my dance. I always knew that dance was something that offered me some quiet in a noisy world. But now I also see dance as something that I've chosen to do with my life. It's not something that necessarily makes me more or less spiritual. It gives me that leeway to harness a quiet mind for the moments in time that I'm dancing. But it's up to me to take that into my life after that also. Because when I'm dancing, I know I'm an amazing person because I forget about myself. I'm just being, I'm listening to the music, I'm honest, I go through emotions that are not mine. I let go of emotions. I don't hang on to any problems. And then life happens after my dance. And right. Then someone someone disturbs you emotionally, and then you react. And then you're like, let go of it. And then you have to remind yourself to let go of it. So it's I'm striving to be the person that I am when I dance.
Yeah. Wow. I hope we can all have that kind of liberation where we're, you know, constantly striving to be that person. But I think it's something that, like you said, you know, the naive person would think it's an escape, but the true artist, I imagine, is, you know, constantly sort of like, again, like you mentioned, striving to be in that place, whether they're dancing or performing their art or not. I wanted to ask you, I'm someone who came to Bharatanatyam because my daughter is a student and she's performed and she's had her Arangetram and whatnot. But I think that initially I myself was perhaps rather rigid in my imagination of what Bharatanatyam is. And I wonder if when people first think of Bharatanatyam, they often think of it rigidly as an ancient art form rather than a living art form. And is it important to come to that, you know, calculus and come to that understanding of it as a living art form? Is that really the secret to unlocking innovation when it comes to dance, and particularly when it comes to an art form like Bharatanatyam?
I don't think that would be the secret. I think that would be a way to make it relevant to you, because anything that is just about preserving tradition becomes a job. but we're not preserving tradition. Yeah. We're living an art and we're creating art from it. So many times when people learn Bharatanatyam, they think about it as preserving a tradition. But I'm carrying a tradition and creating tradition at the same time is how I look at it. So tradition was also created at some point in time. And unless I carry and let it flow, there won't be any new traditions created. So it's not about preserving one tradition. But at the same time, there is a fine balance between saying that it's not about preserving, it's about making new things, and also revering the tradition that it comes from. So I honestly believe that the more you root yourself in the tradition, the greater your branches can grow. So if you are deeply rooted within the tradition, like you keep studying the old varnams and learning the thalams and being as much interested in the source of this art form as you are interested in letting it permeate through you. So it then your voice becomes stronger, is what I believe. Many people think of rejecting the tradition to do something new. But I don't want to reject anything. I think it's a beautiful tradition. And I love dancing the old varnams and the margams and the jatiswarams and the tilanas. But I will also make contemporary work. And I don't need to reject that to make my contemporary work.
It's almost there's a freedom in just adding vocabulary, but recognizing that in order to add vocabulary, you need to know what the traditional vocabulary actually is.
Yeah. It's not about adding vocabulary as it is about shifting the process of using that vocabulary.
Hmm. And is that something that as you shift how you utilize it or how you actually apply the vocabulary, is that where the innovation has come from you?
Yeah, I think for me, it's mainly about saying something and finding the best way to say it. That's all. Hmm.
As you're in that expression.
Yeah.
And how in the different ways that you're saying it. Sure.
Yeah.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with dancer and choreographer Rukmini Vijayakumar. Stay tuned. Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, this is Cal Penn. I'm an actor, author, former public servant, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tam France.
Hi, I am Rahul Mishra.
Hi, my name is Richa Morjani, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Hi there, I'm Abhay Dandekar, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Rukmini Vijayakumar. You mentioned something earlier about, you know, kind of constantly striving to be that person when you dance, constantly thinking about being a student. And I'm curious for you, does dance at its core require one to be quite familiar with unlocking some version of being an inner child? Like, is there some innate quality of constantly thinking of yourself as that, in that inner child version, so that your expression can almost be as pure as it is? Do you have to remind yourself or bring yourself to a place in order for that expression to be liberated, so to speak?
I think there are two aspects to that in a traditional form. In a traditional form, it's really hard because, or a classical form also, not just traditional, like even in ballet or any of these concert art forms. There's so many things that are very specific, like where your hands are placed, where your eyes are, how low you go, which direction your toes point, the way you hold your chest and your body, and do that to the rhythm, your elbows are lifted all through the time, you know? So there's so many precise things within the aesthetic of the form that you need to inculcate in your body. So I want to say the first 15, 16 years of doing Bharatanatyam, you're just worried about where your body parts are going and are they going to the right place. It starts getting fun only when you don't need to think about where it's going anymore because it just knows where to go. So in order to access that freedom or that inner child, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in order to let go. So there are moments that that I try to make even my beginner students have fun, but they're usually places where I don't worry about where their hands or legs are going. They're usually dancing it kind of, you know, ordinarily. So I let them experience the fun of, you know, an imagination or something like that, but they're not doing it properly within the structure of Bharatanatyam.
Yeah.
In order to keep the structure and the aesthetic and the rhythm and all the complexity of the form alive and clear, and also have this freedom, there's a lot of groundwork that needs to happen. It's like sports people, actually, also.
Right, right. The reason I'm asking this in the first place is I think about children as being in many, many ways so uninhibited that they're not thinking about the structure around them. They're just being very, very free with their expression. They don't necessarily have a rigidity of it. And yet what you're saying makes a lot of sense, that you have to get to a certain point where you have that aesthetic and that you've practiced it pretty rigorously. Once you've done that, is unlocking those or getting rid of some of those inhibitions, is that what essentially makes you a better performer?
You can't have any inhibitions to be a performer. Zero, like none.
Hmm.
You can't be worried about how they're seeing you, how anyone is noticing you. Nothing. You just have to be the dance.
I'm curious about this from the aspect of some of your latest performance then in the presentation of the goddess that you've had. There's such a physical and visual celebration of the feminine manifestation and energy, and particularly when it comes to the divine. What did this particular choreography and creation in this production teach you in some ways about your own self-awareness and sense of beauty and strength and grace and power, particularly from what you just said, which is you can't really be cognizant of what someone else is necessarily thinking about how you dance or how you perform?
I think being a choreographer in any production, it's while you're also a dancer, it's really hard. And I think all my previous ensemble work, I would be on stage worrying about my other dancers. Like, did they get it right?
Right.
Did they go to their place? Are they standing in the right place?
Yeah.
And in The Goddess, it's one of the first works where I completely let go of that. And I just danced myself, you know? So I'm not saying there were no moments where I looked at my students and checked on them, but there were way fewer moments for me. So I think that was a learning experience as a performer choreographer. That's one. Also in The Goddess, I choreographed it very differently than my other works. My other ensemble works had a very strong narrative element. the goddess is non-narrative. So it just takes the idea or the energy of what I see as creation or what I see as a beauty, and I try to communicate that through nine bodies on stage. So it's not a narrative thing. It's something where I hope that the audience will leave with a feeling of the strength of the goddess or be overwhelmed by the beauty of the goddess. I also, especially the second piece, I really try to just blend into the ensemble. I don't carry the work as a dancer, as a soloist. The last piece I do a little bit, but the first and second piece, I want everyone to see, like all of us. For me, it's very easy for me to let go of my soloist body, because I think I'm very motherly to my students. So I always want to see them shine. So I don't really need to be that dancer in the middle at all.
Right. Yeah. So you don't need the spotlight in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, I'm waiting to step away from the work actually. So, I mean, the work needs me right now, but.
I'm curious about one last thing. As you continue to develop and evolve as an artist, as a leader, as a teacher, as someone who's exploring so many different venues of art and expression, how has your own vocabulary of art perhaps changed you as a person? Not just as an artist, but perhaps as a person.
I don't know if the art has changed me, but being with people in the art has definitely changed me. And I've learned a lot about myself, my environment, my attachment to the art, which is both a virtue and also a definite like downside in many ways. So in some ways, I think that I've learned to love and respect and revere my art, but also to let go of it, which I didn't know how to do when I was younger. And let go of it in more ways than one, in both in terms of how I needed to be seen, like I would need it to be done in a right way. So I've learned to let go of that, but not in a way where I'm complacent about the work I do, but more in a way that I've done my best and I can't control the choices my students make. I can't control the choices that the rest of the world makes towards the art form. And none of that's my choice. I've also learned to, I think this is more a spiritual growth for me, is that I used to need my art. I used to have to dance to have a good day and be calm and be happy. Now, I can dance, but I need not dance to be happy. And I've learned not to depend on movement art at large to make me feel, you know, kind of that centeredness.
At peace.
So, yeah. 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 But I do it a lot. It's not that I don't, but on the off day, if I didn't dance, like, nobody would talk to me at home because they knew I would be really
uneasy.
Especially in my 20s, I think I was really irritable if I hadn't danced or hadn't done yoga or, you know, had that time for myself.
And let me ask you sort of, and just to capitalize on that one, does being at peace and being content with both who you are and how you approach your day or your week or your year as an artist, is that important enough that it also doesn't prevent you from achieving and that contentness, it still keeps a drive for that achievement even more alive, perhaps?
It keeps the drive for the achievement, but I feel less flustered by whether something happens or not. So it keeps my calm. So a show can go extremely well and I'll be really happy. A show can fall apart and I will tell my students, this is a problem, but I will never carry that angst home. So it is my job to tell them and say what needs to be done, but it's not something that keeps me awake or, like, you know, bothers me or breaks me apart. So it's so that way, because I've let go of it, it helps me also have so much more ease with my environment, my musicians, my dancers, I think even with my students. I think I'm much more in the last, especially the last 5 years, I think I'm much calmer with my art. And it actually lets me do more with less angst.
Well, that calm, that peace, and not having angst is, I'm sure, translating to so much wonderful work and really mesmerizing your audiences, your students, and hopefully yourself and those around you. Rukmini, thank you so much for joining us. This was really a treat to share a conversation with you, and I hope we can do it again sometime down the road.
Thank you so much for having me. It was lovely talking to you.
Thanks so much, Rukmini. Remember that you can find all episodes of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing wherever you listen or watch your podcasts. And again, thanks for any kind ratings or reviews. Hope everyone so far is enjoying a new year that's filled with peace and health. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.